If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On today's episode, you'll hear an interview with the historian and broadcaster Emma Dabbery on her book Don't Touch My Hair. Emma spoke to our World Histories editor, Matt Elton, about what Afro hair can tell us about colonial history.
How would you describe your new book?
Ostensibly, it's about black hair, about Afro-textured hair, the history, politics and significance of hair. But really, it's about a lot more than that. One of my friends who was interviewing me described it as kind of a Trojan horse, something that presents itself as one thing but kind of smuggles in a lot of other ideas.
Mm. And I think that's what interests me so much about it, is that it mixes, sometimes on the same page, history, cultural theory, sociology, memoir, all this stuff all bound together. What was the genesis for you in writing it? What led you to write this particular book?
So I'd written quite a lot about hair before, but only really things of essay length. And I was thinking about what topics I had, because like in my work, I cover quite a broad range of things. There's quite a broad range of things that I've kind of researched. And I was trying to think about a way that I could write about something like seemingly like very specific, but which would allow me to kind of draw on that broad range of research interests. And hair seemed like quite a useful tool to do that.
To start with then, talking about hair, I suppose, as an artifact, something that really interests me in the book is you talk about how societies in Africa can quite often have complex non-verbal languages.
Mm-hmm.
In what cases can we see hair in this capacity?
Yeah, so because of the texture of Afro hair, it's really versatile and it lends itself to being able to be shaped and molded in like a huge multiplicity of ways. So because people had this material that was like a part of their lives and their reality, I guess cultures develop to suit the norms of the people in question. So because the hair can do so much, a kind of strong and lively hair culture emerged. A lot of the cultures that I look at are cultures that would be maybe traditionally described as oral. So the emphasis was on, often on information was disseminated via oral genres, but there's often the assumption, there's often the assumption that when you speak of orality, that it's only talking about the verbal. But in most oral cultures, there will be, like a plethora of other languages. So in the book I mentioned, like Bata, the type of drumming that mimics the tonality of Yoruba, but also visual languages, strong visual languages. So hair would be part of that.
Mm. And is it true that in Yoruba, for instance, there is folklore that has emerged that specifically references hair and hair styling? Is that right?
Yeah, so I looked at, in Yoruba, there's a genre called Oriki, and there's different styles, there's different types of Oriki. But Oriki are essentially, I guess it's translated into like praise poems. So there's, it's not always praise, but like when each person is born, traditionally they'll have their own Oriki, which is essentially like a long name or song that reflects, I guess, the conditions of their birth, stuff about their family, their parents' aspirations for them, et cetera, et cetera. I looked at some of the Oriki of some of the Orisha, and the Orisha are Yoruba deities that are intermediaries between like the supreme being and humans. And one of the very well-known ones, particularly, well, she's a very powerful Orisha, and she traveled to the diaspora, so is also kind of known in the new world, is Oshun, who's associated with the Oshun River. And I looked at some of Oshun's Arikis, and they talk about her as being the kind of primary hairdresser in Yoruba culture. And because she's such an important person, or such an important figure, the idea is that like a lot of the kind of like creativity and innovation that comes from hairstyling is kind of like associated with her. And she's also associated with like beauty and, kind of like beauty. So it makes sense that she would be associated with hairdressing as well.
Hmm. One of the big ideas that you explore in your book is the way in which European settlers, when they first came to Africa, were quite admiring of the cultures they found in a way that was very different from later invaders and later settlers. Can you talk me through that history a bit, I suppose?
Yeah, of course. So you see accounts in the 1600s, in the 1700s, even up until the 1800s, at times where, certainly in the older ones, some of the Portuguese, I think it is, early on, and then Dutch commentators, observers are staggered by the size and organization of some of the cities that they're seeing, they're really impressed. Even later on, when they get into the interior of Nigeria, the British get into the interior of Nigeria in the mid to later 1800s. They've been on the coast for centuries, but they haven't like gotten kind of beyond the coast. There's a passage, I think the guy's called Clapperton. I can't remember off the top of my head. But he's talking about how easy the journey was in terms of how kind of orderly and well-functioning the place is. So he's able to kind of get to where he's going. He's able to hire, and this is actually the introduction of wage labor, which is quite interesting, but he's able to hire guides, and he's just talking about like the kind of the organization and like and the lack of crime. And it really struck me how they're traveling through parts of the continent often that today are seen as like very lawless and dangerous, but in this period, which is supposedly even more underdeveloped, things are actually functioning a lot better than they are today often.
And they often explicitly mention different sorts of hairstyle and ways of doing hair on these journeys, I think, don't they?
Yeah, one of the a lot of the early observers are, one of the things that they're struck by is the kind of is the ornate hairstyling culture and the diversity of hairstyles and the kind of creativity that they see in hairstyles, because they've not seen anything like that before. So there are quite a lot of accounts of hair.
So in these societies in this period and even later, in what ways would time be regarded differently, particularly with regard to hairstyling?
Yeah, so I've dedicated a chapter of the book to talking about time. It's called Ain't Got the Time. And it's the idea came from, or the premise of it was this kind of pretty strongly held concept that black hair in its natural state is too time consuming. So people straighten their hair because that makes it more quote unquote manageable, and you don't have to it's not as burdensome. That whole kind of construction and attitude towards the hair was really of interest to me, because I was just like, no, it surely can't be that this hair is deviant. It must grow the way it grows for a particular reason. But it's as though the society that we live in now, which is obviously kind of capitalism is the underpinning logic of it. Under capitalism, time has been repurposed to be about the maximization of profit. So anything that isn't seen as productive in that way is a burden or is time consuming. So I started looking at how different African groups had organized time before the imposition of wage labor and capitalism and colonialism. And that was absolutely fascinating in that context where man, I think there's a quote from John Beattie where he says, man is not a slave of time, but he makes as much time as he wants. This idea that whatever people kind of prioritize, and one of the things that they prioritized was their hairstyling, people have time to do that. It's only within a different system, which has been created with kind of different standards and norms, that the hair is reimagined as burdensome.
What were some of the reasons why later visitors to Africa, I say visitors, came to regard hair as less positive, less attractive in their eyes?
Yeah. So when there's a shift, when slavery and later colonialism become the primary reasons that Europeans are in the continent, the more complementary descriptions, the more positive descriptions, are quite drastically replaced by far more negative ones. There's this idea that Africans are incredibly idle, again, going back to time, that they're not using their time productively, i.e. for the kind of maximization of profit. So part of the justification of slavery and these kind of oppressive regimes and systems of extraction is that these people aren't fully, they're not people, they're not fully human. And one of, there are many ways in which this idea was advanced, but one of them was they don't even have hair. So European people have hair, but African people have wool, and that's more akin in this idea. They have wool that's more akin to kind of livestock and animals. So therefore, there's a justification for kind of enslavement and for colonialism, because it's a civilizing mission, and it's actually bringing the light of civilization to the dark continent.
This view was incredibly toxic, not just for European people, but for the people who suffered through this, wasn't it? In what ways does this legacy still live on in the ways in which people regard their own hair, even today?
Yeah, so because this was such a... because these narratives were so powerful, and because the power dynamic was so balanced in favor of white European norms. And you see when there's the kind of extraction of all of these people from Africa, taken to taken to the Americas primarily, but other parts of the world as well. There is, very much this idea of Afro-textured hair as inadequate, as inferior, as lesser than, as even kind of associated with this kind of non-humanity. So these ideas are internalized, and the hair is seen as like so other and so deviant and so problematic that the kind of that process of assimilation develops, and you see the birth of hair straightening and this attempt to make the hair resemble European hair.
What are some of the techniques that people, that you even may have used to help achieve this aim?
The most permanent one is called relaxer. And that is a process of chemical straightening of the hair that was first invented just over 100 years ago in the US. And actually, when kind of like recently emancipated African-Americans, the first kind of like hair capitalists or the first kind of self-made black millionaires were often women who were involved in the production and marketing and selling of hair relaxer. So it's a chemical process which deforms the elliptical shape of the hair and breaks it and makes it straight. You can achieve kind of a facsimile of European hair.
It
works. It completely transforms the way that your hair looks. But there are, there's lots of associated costs, but there are like health costs. There's the kind of an association of the chemicals that are used with endocrine disruption and cancers and fertility issues and fibroids and lots of things like that. Also, when I relax my hair for probably about 15 years, maybe slightly less. And I would always have like burns, because you also get chemical burns. So I'd always have burns on my scalp. But I didn't really mind them, even though they were obviously painful. They were painful. But in my mind, I'd be like, oh, I know my this is evidence that like my hair has gotten like even straighter. So in a way, I wasn't that bothered by them.
So the pressure that you felt to look a particular way was so strong that you were happy to put up with actually burning your skin in order to achieve this look.
Yeah, chemical burns. I mean, it's staggering to think about now and the level of cognitive dissonance. But the way I saw it was as though I just had like a chronic malaise and it was just something that required treatment. And this was the treatment. That's how I imagined it.
Do you think that white hair is held up as a paragon then of what a beauty ideal is across society?
So I think the beauty standard comes from the West, but the most idealized kind of iteration of that hair is actually probably Asian people's hair, because most of the week, it's straight, but it's actually European hair can actually be quite thin. But Asian hair is straight, but is like thicker and fuller. So usually when weaves are made, which is the hair that people attach to their head in this process of transformation, it's more likely to be Asian hair than European hair. But the beauty standard is definitely one that comes from kind of a Western beauty standard.
Does this external and then internalized sort of dislike of certain types of hair extend to men as well? Do you think men also suffer this pressure?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a chapter of the book where I focus more on men's hair. And I've spoken to men actually who told me that they've like texturized their hair, which is kind of a type of relaxer. It's not fully as, rather than making the hair bone straight, it gives it like a loose curl, because there's also like a hierarchy of like what type of curly hair you have. I'll often have white people say to me, oh yeah, I've got curly hair. I kind of understand where you're coming from. And I'm like, I get it. Like curly hair is definitely a thing, but it's actually like not stigmatized in the same way that like Afro textured hair is. And then there's like a hierarchy of types of hair whereby like the most Afro textured hair is like the most kind of reviled. And then there's mixed people who will have mixed ancestry somewhere down the line who have a looser curl that is like different to bone straight hair, but is definitely perceived as maybe the beauty standard of black hair and is more comparable to the type of curly hair that some white people have. Even though I'm mixed, my hair very much favored the African side of my heritage. So I don't have those loose curls. But yeah, so men who would texturize their hair to achieve that kind of looser, more loosely curled look. Or I recently a guy told me he actually like straightened his hair, and he said it was because in school he was just sick of being like petted. He just felt like he was like an animal, basically, and he didn't want that to happen, so he had a period of straightening his hair. So these are definitely issues that affect men as well, but I think maybe we associate it more with women because for women there's been until recently more of a culture of long hair being very entwined with ideas about femininity and womanhood.
Can we trace all of this back to the sort of experience of slavery, and are there other historical things that caused this situation?
There's no stigma associated with Afro-textured hair in the continent before you have this kind of dehumanization of black people. So this is very much something that has its origins in that kind of power relationship that emerges from European expansion and then slavery and colonialism, yeah.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Throughout the 80s and 90s and into the noughties, straight hair remained the default. It was only with the kind of birth of what is called the natural hair movement that you start to see people rejecting those relaxers and going back to not straightening their hair.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I wanted to talk a bit about black power and the Afro hairstyle. Could you talk through what the Afro hairstyle is and the extent to which it is truly African?
Yeah, sure. So the quite, I guess, iconic looking Afro is, I guess, what a lot of people would think of when they think of natural Afro textured hair. So it's leaving the hair to just grow as it does naturally from the head, kind of like unmanipulated. And black people's or Afro textured hair grows up and out rather than down, which some people have told me they've been like shocked by reading that in the book, which is like, I make the point of saying it, but I assume that like everyone kind of knows it, but people have been like, oh my God, that blew my mind. I'm just like, wow, okay. So yeah, there's the assumption that everybody's hair grows like in the same direction. And I guess people often ask me, oh, how long is your hair? And they're kind of like this. And I'm like, oh, that's not really a meaningful reference. This, oh, it's not great for a podcast, sorry. But the assumption that it grows down, they kind of make a motion to their shoulders. But yeah, so the Afro is, as I write in the book, women in like Yoruba culture wouldn't have ever really left their hair out in that way. Hair was always like braided or twisted. And that's also because of the texture of Afro hair. If it's out for too long, it is prone to dryness because of the shape of it. And it's also like prone to tangling and breaking. So moisturizing it and twisting it moisturizing it and braiding it is kind of more typically how hair was groomed. Because Afro textured hair, I guess because of the name and because it's the way our hair grows naturally, there's the association that this is, or there's the assumption that this is like the most kind of like African style of hairdress. But in actual fact, it's more of a diaspora response to racism. It's a retaliation against that stigma associated with hair. It's like, oh, you're saying my hair is kind of ugly and lesser than, so I'm going to like showcase it in its kind of like full resplendency and glory. So it's wearing it out. But that imperative wasn't really there in like pre-colonial West Africa. So people didn't have to make that statement. And more typically, yeah, their hair would be braided. Hair wouldn't really be left out in an Afro, as it were. Also in Africa, in some of the aesthetics that I talk about in the book, we're looking at the Ashanti people, looking at the Yoruba people, artifice was actually an aesthetic norm. So to just leave your hair wasn't really the beauty standard there. It was what was considered beautiful was more of like the intervention in the hair. So the skill of the braided hairstyle or the skill of what was created with your hair was what rendered it kind of aesthetically pleasing. So the Afro, Kobina Mercer makes the argument that the Afro can be linked back to the kind of romanticism of European notions of romanticism and the idea that to leave something in its natural state is kind of beautiful and something to aspire to. And he kind of links that, the Afro, to the kind of hippie movement and how white people were growing their hair long and it was uncombed and this was seen as countercultural and revolutionary. So I think that argument that the Afro can be kind of located within the norms of European romanticism is quite interesting as well and unexpected.
Yes, and we'll go back to that. To go back to the braiding and the twisting just very briefly, something that's interesting in the book is the idea that this was an activity around which society could form and interact and you could build community through this action. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So rather than being seen as like a time-consuming burden, the hours spent in grooming and in doing one another's hair were seen as important social time where information was exchanged. Also just kind of like strengthening the bonds of society. It is actually very intimate and there's a lot of like physical proximity. So it's just having that intimacy with a child or with a parent or with somebody that you're close to and having those hours spent together are times of, yeah, kind of important social bonding. Mm.
And to go back to the Afro, in popular, very broad culture, that's associated with a specific point in time, which I suppose is the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
What led to its diminishing as a cultural symbol.
Yeah, so the Afro was, I guess, popularized by Black Power, and initially, and the Black Panthers and that kind of very revolutionary, anti-consumerist, anti-capitalist, revolutionary socialist moment. But the hairstyle was increasingly commodified, and certainly wasn't extended far beyond kind of activists and proponents of Black Power. And with its commodification, I guess a lot of the political intent behind it diminished. And maybe the beauty standard had never really shifted, because by the 80s and the end of Black Power, you see the reemergence of straight hair again as the default kind of normal, quote unquote, thing that Black women, and actually in the 80s, men as well, would do, because that's where you have the emergence of like the Jerry curl and the S curl, and all of those texturizing treatments for men and women. So yeah, throughout the 80s and 90s and into the noughties, straight hair remained the default. It was only with the kind of birth of what is called the natural hair movement that you start to see people rejecting those relaxers and the texturizers were already gone, rejecting relaxer and going back to not straightening their hair. But the difference between that and the earlier incarnation that's associated with Black Power is a lot of people are quite adamant that them not straightening their hair, that it isn't political. It's just something that their primary motivation isn't political. Yeah.
But it sounds to me like hair is political in this context. And are there ways in which people today can reclaim their hair and use it as a political symbol? And should they?
Yeah, I don't want to say, I don't want to kind of argue that anyone should do anything. And I don't want to like police anybody's, Black people are just like, Black people's bodies are so kind of heavily policed anyway. I don't want to kind of do that any further and be like, you should wear your hair this way or you shouldn't wear your hair that way. Everybody has their own reasons and motivations for how they wear their hair. And there is, there is so much kind of creativity and innovation in Black hairstyling culture that there are so many different types of hairstyles that you can choose from. But for me personally, me making the decision to stop relaxing my hair was political. And I knew that the reasons that I was relaxing my hair were because of like shame associated like with my hair texture. So I had to kind of undo all of that and accept and embrace the actual texture that my hair is. And by stopping relaxing, and I had to like seek out other ways of like grooming it and maintaining it. And for me, I do style my hair in a lot of kind of like traditional like braided hairstyles. My hair will usually be braided in some way if it's not out in an afro. So for me, it was political. Yeah.
You talk in the book about cultural appropriation, which is one of those things that's had a big moment recently. It's mm-hmm. been in the media a lot. How do those concepts fit into this idea, do you think?
Yeah. So cultural appropriation is really relevant to hair, because one of the, flashpoints where we've seen kind of accusations of cultural appropriation has been around white people, often white celebrities, styling their hair in styles that are traditional Black hairstyles. And the issue, I guess, I mean, if the world was different and there was a level playing field between Black and white, there wouldn't be any issue. Anybody should be able to style their hair any way they want to. But when you look at the context of reality, there's not a level playing field. The same hairstyles that a white celebrity will be celebrated for and will be lauded for, kind of by high fashion, by the media, are the same hairstyles that Black children will be excluded from schools for, or Black employees will be told are inappropriate for work. And that was happening, like the kind of discrimination that existed has been, the level of discrimination has been recognized by the city of New York, which has recently just brought in legislation making it illegal to discriminate against Black people on the grounds of their hair, because it was happening with such frequency. So it's the disparity between the way the white person who chooses these hairstyles is treated versus the Black person who actually needs to use those type of hairstyles, because that's how we maintain our hair. And also, when you think again about the context, I think a lot of the relationship between Africa and Europe and the descendants of Africans in the last 500 years has been a process of extraction of resources for the benefit of Western economies, financial, cultural economies, and it's the extraction of like all of physical resources, of material resources, of cultural resources. And that kind of facsimile of Blackness that celebrities will create or will appropriate, which makes them kind of edgy and hugely successful performers, but which Black people are demonized for, is part of that process of extraction. So I know people want to often dismiss cultural appropriation as something like really frivolous and silly and shallow. And if you look at it beyond any context, you're like, oh, it's just about hair, and hair is like really superficial. That's how people can construct that argument. But that argument belies an ignorance of the larger picture. So yeah,
You write in the book that everything you've been taught about Africa is a lie, and it's a story designed to justify the continent's exploitation. Mm-hmm. Which is what you're saying here, isn't it? Is that we are unknowingly or knowingly part of this wider story? Mm-hmm. How would you like this book to change people's impression of hair and its importance and its significance?
Yeah, so more so than just changing people's attitudes towards the significance of hair, I want them to reassess how they think about things like cultural appropriation, how they think about pre-colonial African societies, how they think about African society and culture. And the quote that you just referenced is from the final chapter, which is called Ancient Futures, Maths, Mapping and Encoding. And in that, I look at the relationship between braided hairstyles and fractal mathematics, fractal design. And I talk about different calculating systems that are indigenous African technologies, and this kind of lively mathematical history that exists in the continent. And it's not something we ever really hear about because it doesn't fit the narrative of African primitivism. We always hear these kind of stereotypes about Black people excelling, you know, kind of in terms of the physical, so in athletics, in sports, but we don't really hear about any of those more, I guess, what are seen as like intellectual or cerebral traditions. So it was really important for me to, I want there to be stereotypes about Black people and maths. I can't imagine that happening anytime soon. But uncovering that history was really fascinating for me. So if the book can bring some of those ideas that are not widely perpetuated or widely known to broader audiences, that would be great. Yeah, that would be great.
That was Emma Dabbery. Emma's book, Don't Touch My Hair, is out now, published by Alan Lane. You can read Matt's interview with Emma in issue 17 of BBC World Histories magazine, which is on sale now. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Thursday when I'll be speaking to the author Harry Potter about the history of British prisons.